And tonight on Coast to Coast, we are going to dive deep into the mind, human consciousness. It's called Infinite Awareness, and we'll be back with Marjorie Hines Woollacott next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, I'm looking forward to tonight. Marjorie Hines Woollacott, PhD, has been a neuroscience professor at the University of Oregon for more than 3 decades. Master's degree in Asian studies, where she began teaching on sabbatical. Her master's thesis was the foundation for her latest book that I'm holding in my hand, Infinite Awareness, The Awakening of a Scientific Mind. Now, that's about a scientist's memoir and memory about the research survey on human consciousness. Marjorie, welcome to the program. First time, I believe, right?
It is, yes. Thank you very much, George.
I'm looking forward to this. Now, tell me about being a neuroscientist. Exactly what is that?
Well, first of all, I should say that I was trained as a neuroscientist in rehabilitation medicine. So that means I work with patients with stroke, Parkinson's disease, children with cerebral palsy, and I work to really help them walk and move better. And I've published a textbook for clinicians on rehabilitation that's in its 5th edition, which takes the research I've been doing and others have been doing and translates it into clinical practice. And I've had grants from National Institutes of Health to do that research, totaling millions of dollars. I've had over 140 research publications in rehab medicine. Right. So I'm really immersed in that culture of neuroscientists. And I should mention that like other neuroscientists, I've had that view that human awareness is solely the product of neurons in our brain. I've been a materialist neuroscientist like almost everyone else in my field. And I should say that then at the same time early on in my career, I had a very interesting experience, and that is that my sister, who was involved in meditation, invited me to a meditation retreat. And I'm a skeptical scientist, but it was my birthday and I wanted to see her, so I was curious as well and I went ahead and came. And I had an experience in that meditation retreat that was unlike anything I'd ever had before as a neuroscientist. And what happened was that in the very first meditation session, I began to feel this energy pulsing like from the very core of my being, from my heart, and like radiating outward. And it felt like nectar, like this pure love and this joy like pouring through me. And I felt, I'm home. And I realized I was feeling like my own heart, my own inner being was like this new home that I hadn't even been aware of before. And I felt like I had this new connection with other people in the world, with other things in the world. And, of course, I thought, my goodness, what on earth is this? And I went back to my university position, and I started meditating every day almost spontaneously because this felt so good to do.
Now, was this experience based on just you alone, or were you tapping into the others who might have been there, too?
Well, that's an interesting point that you make. In fact, this was a meditation initiation, and in fact, there was an Indian Swami that was there who was actually initiating us into meditation. And what actually happened is he came around and he touched me on the bridge of my nose, right between my eyes, and as he did that, I actually felt like this mini electric current going into my chest. And then that incredible experience of like expansion and love went into me like something was awakened inside of me that hadn't been awake before, like a whole new level of awareness.
Were you sold on this consciousness after that, or did you still have to do some work on it?
Actually, it was almost like I was, I give this example to some of my friends, like a little chicken gets imprinted on their mother when they're first hatched. And I had that same feeling about my first awareness of meditation. It's like this particular meditation like really was so powerful for me in that moment that I just went right back home and I started meditating using those methods and those tools. Saying that, I think that almost all paths of meditation are very similar, and I think that the purpose of paths of meditation are really to awaken you to this inner experience and to quiet your mind so that you can really get in touch with it most of the day.
At what point, Marjorie, did you start to research meditation?
Well, it took about 20, 25 years for me to do that.
Oh,
it was
okay.
One of the odd things. I mean, if you can imagine, here you are going to the lab every day and you're doing your research in the laboratory on rehabilitation, and then you're going to your meditation programs. And I actually taught meditation and I taught yoga. So I would say one set of experiences to my friends that were in meditation and yoga and when I was teaching yoga. And then I would give a whole different set of experiences to my colleagues in neuroscience. And it was partly because I knew that if I mentioned those things to my colleagues in neuroscience, they would give me sort of like an amused, a disdainful, or sort of an alarmed look if they heard that I meditated, because I was not credible if I was doing something like that.
What took you so long?
You know, it's a very good question. I think it was this being in the middle of your career as a neuroscientist, it's really frightening to think that you might lose your credibility. It is like your whole identity as a neuroscientist. And so I'm thinking that's part of it. And I should mention that there were a few awkward moments socially for me when my husband, who is a meditator and who loves things like alternative medicine and Reiki and things like
that. He's our kind of guy. That's what we like.
Our kind of guy. And we would be at a party with my neuroscience friends, and he would start talking about, for example, Reiki, and I would go, I would kick him off under the table, and I'd say, be quiet,
yeah,
because
quiet.
I was so afraid.
You're going to kill my career, right?
Exactly. You're going to kill my career.
Well, you know what, though? He was right.
He
was right,
he was right
about all this.
He was. And, of course, I knew he was right at one level, and the other side of me was so afraid to talk about it that I just tried to keep him quiet. And you said, so how did things begin to come together? Well, one thing that happened is that I said, I can't live this schizophrenic existence any longer. It's just, it's really hard to do that, sort of like almost a private life that you have.
Really, it is. And you're afraid who's going to find out and everything else. It's an awkward feeling.
Yeah. So finally I said, okay, I'm going to actually attack it from both sides. And I first started to do research in my laboratory on meditation. I thought, well, at least I can, from the neuroscientist perspective, say, what's really going on in meditation? And can we, in the laboratory, measure the electrical activity in the brain that actually changes as a result of meditation? So that was my first foray. And I'll just tell you briefly about one of the studies, which I thought was interesting. And that is that we compared meditators and people who are Tai Chi practitioners, because that's a form of moving meditation, aerobic walkers, because people say that aerobic walking is very good for improving our attention. So we thought, well, that's in the public eye, we'll try that too, and then sedentary adults. And we gave them a very difficult attentional task. It's a computer game where you need to press keys quickly and to respond to rules that are constantly changing.
Okay.
And so you have to have intense focus.
And you're being tested? Is that what's happening?
And you're being, say that again?
Are you being tested when you're doing this game?
Exactly. Okay. Right. So people are trying to be as fast as they can in terms of doing this, definitely. And what we found was that we had an EEG cap of 256 electrodes over the head so that we could measure the brain activity.
Wow,
when
that's
people
a lot.
Were doing the game.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
I know when you go out and get an EEG for your heart, they give you like six or seven of them. That's about it.
That's right. That's right. But for the EEG, we wanted to be able to actually record activity from the entire brain. And what we found was that when the stimulus from the computer came on, if people were really focused, they would have a very large event-related potential, which is this giant spike in the EEG. And we found that, in fact, it was the meditators and the Tai Chi practitioners that had these very large event-related potentials. The sedentary adults had very small ones, and the aerobic fitness people were about halfway in between. So I think it was really a good sign that they really do use their attention in a much more effective way after they've been practicing meditation or Tai Chi, a moving meditation.
And Marjorie, when you talk about meditation, tell us about the technique or the style that you're talking about.
Right. I think it's a very simple form of meditation that, again, I would say is used across most cultures and most traditions in the world. I'm talking about sitting quietly, closing the eyes and beginning to focus on the breath, and simply very gently watching the in-breath, watching it stop for that brief moment, and then watching the out-breath, and just keeping my mind aware of the breath going in and going out. So it's a very simple thing that can be done by anyone. And I typically meditate myself for about 45 minutes to an hour a day, because I find that the longer I meditate, the further inside I can get in terms of a still mind, and then access these other realms that I have experienced before.
That was the next question. When you meditate, what happens? What abilities do you create?
Well, and so this is an interesting thing. So I typically feel energy centers in my body when I meditate. And I think this is interesting for me as a scientist, because you see those pictures of a yogi and you see these chakras or these meditation energy centers sort of along the spinal column. And some people think, well, that's so just sort of a cartoon, you know, what is that? But literally, when I meditate, I feel energy in my heart expanding. I feel energy between my eyes and at the crown of my head. And it's this delicious energy. It feels like totally blissful and peaceful, and I feel very contented. And I should mention one other experience, because it reminded me, when I read a little bit about your own biography, about how when you were 11, was it, you had that out-of-body experience?
Yep, I sure did. It was a weird feeling, Marjorie. Bouncing against the ceiling, not knowing what was going on, other than I knew it wasn't a dream.
Yes. So that happened to me probably early on in my meditation practice, maybe after I'd been meditating for like 3 or 4 years. I would get up in the morning at around 4 o'clock, and I would meditate. And then at the end of my meditation, I would just lie back on the floor and rest in a yoga posture called the corpse pose. It's just an easy way to relax for 10 minutes. And during that time, I was halfway between sleep and waking, and all of a sudden, I found my awareness sort of, like you said, like on the very ceiling of my room. And for me, it was a very joyful, freeing experience. And it was like, oh, wow, you know, I'm above my body, and I could look down on the body. And then it lasted only for a few seconds, and I could feel my energy beginning to move right back down into the body. And it was like, darn, I didn't keep it there.
once you meditate, though, once you get into this groove of meditating, what did it do for you? Did you illuminate your consciousness? Did your intuitiveness increase? What happened?
Actually, all those things. I think, so first of all, just being in that state each morning for about 45 minutes to an hour, I find makes me calmer during my day, so that when I'm interacting with others during my day, I'm not thrown off balance like I used to be thrown off balance. I can stay centered. I can stay calm in a situation. If something challenging comes up, I don't get a lot of anxiety about it. And that really is very helpful. So that's one thing that I think is life transforming. And when I've looked at other people's research on meditation, I think they say the same thing. They say that we tend to be much more in control of our emotions, and also more in the present moment. We're able to deal with what's happening right now, and then just let our emotions flow through us and not get attached and contracted about different situations and hold on to them and be angry and upset.
And Marjorie, here's the puzzlement of all of this. Is this developed by the brain or outside of the brain into this realm that we've always talked about that is out there?
Yeah. And I think that is a very, very good question. And I believe that it's probably a little bit of both, because having done my own research studies of other people's work on consciousness and whether it actually exists beyond the brain, and like you, I believe it does, I feel that this understanding that consciousness is really a non-local phenomenon that is much vaster than our own brains, and that basically what our brain is doing is acting like a reducing valve or a filter that gives us only a limited access to that awareness that is out there. I think what's probably happening is that when we meditate, we're both changing circuits in our brain. We know that's happening from the neuroscience research on meditation, but we're also changing something else in terms of our broader ability to access these realms that I never had before I started meditating.
Well, with Dr. PhD Marjorie Woollacott, we're talking about her work and research, Infinite Awareness. When you were doing the research, how did you select the various aspects, topics that you went after?
Well, first of all, I began to look at the research literature on consciousness actually existing beyond the brain activity, because as a neuroscientist, I'd always been skeptical. And I said, let me go and look at the scientific literature. So what is out there that's actually in peer-reviewed, highly regarded journals? And I was surprised to find that near-death experiences have been carefully studied by cardiologists in hospitals, and they have done carefully designed studies to actually look at the validity of these experiences. So that's one of the ways that I actually decided what to look at. I first chose near-death experiences because they have been so well studied.
It's an amazing field, isn't it? Just being able to study this, it's just incredible.
Yes. And I'm amazed, too, at the, at the creativity of these people. I think a person that I have read a fair amount about is Dr. Pim van Lommel, who's from the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And he did one of these first carefully designed studies. They call it a prospective study, where they bring in everybody to the hospital that has a cardiac arrest. And then they look at their brain activity to see whether it is truly flat, which it should be if you've had cardiac arrest. They look at their blood chemistry to see how the oxygen in the blood is. And then they interview all those people that survive. And he found that 12% of the cardiac arrest patients did have conscious near-death experiences, even though their body, including their brain, was functionally dead as far as the clinicians were concerned. And 25% of those people had experiences that indicated they were watching and recalling events that happened during their cardiac arrest from above them. So literally, they were outside their body.
That's right. Now, did you become a believer in that, or did you think this was a hallucination, part of the dying process?
Well, I mean, at first I looked carefully at the literature, and I certainly read the neuroscience skeptic point of view, which is basically that the brain neurons are simply dying, and therefore they're releasing a lot of transmitter, and that causes hallucinations. And yet, when you look at these studies, whether it's Pim van Lommel or another man, Dr. Bruce Grayson from University of Virginia Medical School, Sam Parnia is another from New York Stony Brook, they all carefully refute those particular hypotheses of the neuroscience skeptics. And they say, first of all, that if there were an excessive neurotransmitter release, or there were basically too little oxygen in the blood, they said you would get very confused memories, but you wouldn't get these hyper-vivid experiences. That's impossible to have happen when you have a totally disorganized brain that's dying. And he said, besides, it's not that there's just low brain activity. There is no brain activity. He said, after 30 to 40 seconds of no cardiac rhythm, you have no brain activity. And the other thing, of course, is that if you are looking down on an operating room and watching everybody in it, and your eyes are taped shut, because that's what they often do in these situations to keep the eyes from getting dried out, you shouldn't be able to see anything. And also, you would not be able to be have all of your things you've seen verified by the people in the operating room, which is what happens. So it's like it can't be explained by our neuroscience views.
Marjorie, prior to all of this, were you a believer in life after death?
No, I should tell you, from the time I was a little kid, I was basically a scientist through and through. And I think in my book, I talk about the first time I actually did my own scientific dissection was when I was 5, and my mother had killed a gopher outside that was digging tunnels in our yard. And I got a kitchen knife out, and I went into the dead gopher to look inside of his body.
Yeah, you were curious. You weren't a mean little kid with a knife. You were curious.
I was curious, and I was fascinated at what I found. But so that was where I came. And, of course, in neuroscience, that view is actually constantly reinforced when you take your classes. They say, of course, there can't be any consciousness beyond the brain, and there can't be any life after death. And so it was only in that meditative experience when everything shifted for me like 180 degrees. And it was like, oh, my God, there really is something more than I'd ever experienced before.
So you are a believer now in life after death.
Absolutely. There's
now,
no question.
Let me take it a little further.
Yeah.
Do you believe in God?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that everyone has their own definition of God.
Yes.
And some people may consider God to be a very personal
yeah.
entity, and others may consider God to be this vast infinite awareness,
right.
this wonderful power.
It's not a guy
love.
In a cloud, though. I'll tell you that.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And so I think that my experience from meditation is of this incredibly loving, knowledgeable, infinite awareness, caring, that I can access now in meditation anytime I want, which is wonderful.
Marjorie, we're going to come back in a moment and talk about reincarnation, energy healing, all of this. Infinite Awareness is the name of the book. Marjorie Hines-Wolacott on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with our guest, Marjorie Hines-Wolacott, her book, Infinite Awareness. How'd you get the title, by the way? Tell me about that.
Well, I think that I realized that as a neuroscientist, I had always thought that awareness was absolutely finite, and there was this incredible transformation that happens when you begin to meditate or you have a near-death experience, you have one of these out-of-body experiences that really makes you feel like you are connected with everything else in the universe and other people in a whole new way. And so it felt like that was the experience I was wanting to really tell people about that was possible really for all of us.
Indeed, indeed. Marjorie, let's talk now about the research that you did and your search for other scientists that you really wanted to react to this. How did you go about that?
Well, I first of all found that it was very interesting to begin to look at the research on, for example, the PubMed website, which is a major publications in our country from the government that has all of the journals on such things as near-death experiences and other neuroscience, and then begin to talk to some of these researchers that have actually done the research. And I had a very amazing experience doing that where I went, I actually emailed Ed Kelly, who's at the University of Virginia, who wrote a wonderful book called Irreducible Mind, and mentioned that I was doing my own research in the area, and he invited me out to their laboratory in Charlottesville and allowed me to actually talk with each one of the scientists that have been doing work on reincarnation, on near-death experiences, et cetera. And I had a whole new understanding about what these people were doing by hearing their own backgrounds as to how they actually got into this research themselves. And it was an enlightening phenomenon because, as I said, most neuroscientists who do this type of research do not talk about it to other people.
But the ones that you were able to get, were you happy with?
I was amazed. So, I mean, Ed Kelly was the first example, and he is the head of this group at the University of Virginia and in the medical school and the Division of Perceptual Studies. And he actually told me about how when he was at Harvard University as a PhD student in psychology, he was doing his normal research in psychology, and his mother called him up at one point to say that a relative of theirs was actually a medium at some particular church that she had belonged to, and his mother was concerned, what did that mean to be a medium, and was that okay, was that bad? And she said, oh, you're in psychology, would you do some research and tell me what that means? And so he said he was amazed. He went up to the library stacks at Harvard, and he found out that William James, the father of modern psychology, who wrote in the late 1900s and early, the late 1800s and early 1900s, had written a lot about parapsychology, and in fact believed that there was consciousness beyond a brain. In many of his writings, he talks about that. And so basically, Ed Kelly said, oh my goodness, there's this incredible amount of research out there, and he became more interested in it. And in fact, he then had some of his own experiences as he began to meditate himself, and one in which he actually felt his body and his awareness expand to be the size of the room that he was in when he was meditating. And he said that that really changed his whole understanding of what consciousness is from his own experiences again. And then he began doing more and more research on others to learn more about it.
Of everything that you've looked at so far, Marjorie, or researched, what do you find as the single most fascinating aspect? Near-death experiences, telepathy, you know, clairvoyance?
Wow.
Is there anything that stands out?
Well, so it would be actually two things. I mean, part of it is that when I've talked to people that have had near-death experiences, and I have one particular case that I interviewed a woman who was an MD who had it. I think that For me, it especially stands out because she, like me and most other MDs, basically was an avowed atheist before she had that experience. And so the transformation that occurs in the person due to that experience is phenomenal. And maybe I can just tell you a little bit
about
it.
Yeah, I'd like to know what happened. Sure. She was a medical doctor, too, specialist or just a general practitioner?
She was a general practitioner. She had just been, she had received her MD a few years earlier, and she was now, had been working in a hospital in the Boston area for about 2 years.
Okay.
And she had already had twins, and she was now had her second pregnancy and was expecting a little girl. And what the her own doctor told her is that this was a high-risk pregnancy because the placenta covered the birth canal. And what that means is there's a high risk of bleeding, and that can be very dangerous to both the mother and the child. And so they said, we want you to be on bed rest, and then as soon as the child is viable independently, we will go ahead and do a cesarean section. And that will probably be the easiest thing to do. But they told her this was high risk. So they put her in the operating room when everything was ready, and she was put under anesthesia. Her eyes were taped shut, and everything seems to be going fine until suddenly she suddenly becomes wide awake again. And she hears the anesthesiologist say, her blood pressure is plummeting fast. And then a few moments later, she hears the word, shit. And she realizes he's saying he couldn't detect any blood pressure at all.
You can't say that, by the way.
I know you can't, right?
You can't say that on the radio. No.
So I apologize for what the anesthesiologist said. And she then said that she noticed something inside of herself that nobody else was aware of. There was this strange stillness that was spreading throughout her chest. And she realized something was missing. And she understood then that it was her heartbeat. And she said for a moment she was the only person in the operating room who realized it, and then suddenly she heard these strident beeps as the cardiac monitor registered it itself. And Peyton said she saw the anesthesiologist then slam his hand into a large red button on the wall because he was calling a code to get the emergency resuscitation team in. And so she said at this point something new happened. She said she had this feeling she was about to die. And then this inner vision of a vast darkness expanded inside of her, and she leaned backwards into this darkness in her awareness, and she felt herself fall, gliding backward and downward in this graceful backward arc. When I hear that, I keep thinking of like diving backward into a pool. And she said the darkness was vividly black with particles of sparkling light, and she felt this presence in the light. She felt this pulsating power. And she said she was incredibly happy, vividly happy, and at peace.
Let me be the devil's advocate for a moment, though.
Yeah.
How do we know that what's happening to these people is not just some kind of anomaly in the brain at the dying stage, that something happens in the brain, as you've been talking about, and that it's not your dearly departed loved ones who visit you or any of that. It's just a dying process, and everybody goes through it. And then you close your eyes, and that's it.
And I think the reason why is that she basically was wide awake and alert. And when in my book, I talk about how she said she was hyper aware. In other words, her consciousness was not confused like you would expect of a dying brain.
Mm-hmm.
It was not in any way dim. She was like hyper alert, and she was aware of everything around her. So I don't understand myself how that could happen, how a neuroscientist could claim that when your brain is dying and you have all these neurotransmitters released that you go into a hyper-aware state. You should go into a very dimly chaotic mm-hmm. aware state.
Now, it's very controversial between doctors and scientists regarding the dying process, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I think you're right. And when you say that, I think that the doctors that have actually been with patients through these experiences, and especially doctors that are like hospice doctors, have a much different experience than do neuroscientists. And partly I think it's that neuroscientists have never had an experience themselves, it's beyond their limited normal awareness of their brain activating their own consciousness. And so it takes having some sort of an experience ourselves often to really believe in something. That's
now, let's add to this, Marjorie, with your studies of reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
And how does that fit into this?
Right. So this is a much harder one for me. So as a neuroscientist, as I began to look at the research, I started looking at the work of Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia, Antonia Mills, who was at Northern British Columbia University, and also Haraldsson, who's at the University of Iceland. A number of people are doing studies on these cases suggestive of reincarnation. And I think the hardest part for me here is that as a neuroscientist, we can't imagine that there's a way that a spirit could go from one body to another. We just believe that you are the genes of your parents, and that's exactly all you really are. And so here I am reading these cases, and I should say that Stevenson accumulated over 2,500 cases of these very young children that are often 2.5, 3.5 years of age that have these experiences where they tell their parents they are not their parents, that they come from a different town that's often maybe a half an hour away or a long distance away. And I'm saying to myself as I'm reading these studies, it's like, no scientist would believe this if I put this in my book. It's impossible for us to like really actually validate all of these things. But then as I read more and more carefully the work that was done by Stevenson and others, I found that they have treated these cases of suggestive of reincarnation like the law community does, where they very carefully interview all of the witnesses, and they look at newspaper reports, they look at birth records, they look at autopsy reports, and they have carefully look to see if there's any chance that there is fraud. And they typically never report a case if there is any fraud at all, and they rarely, rarely find that.
It is dramatic, and I mean, I'm a believer. I had doubts about the near-death experience, and then I came back to reality again to believe that it does exist. There's something else out there. Always was.
Yeah.
But it's easy to go astray and not understand it and not believe it.
It is. And I think what I appreciated about the people that have done these cases, so as I was writing the book, I literally probably reviewed about, 75 different cases that were written up by these various researchers. And the data that they have totally convinces me. And I mean, one example is this little boy named Titu Singh that was from northern India. He was from a small town near Agra in India, and his dad was a chemistry teacher. They lived in a little one-story cement house, and he started talking at about the age of 1.5, which is much earlier than his brothers or his sisters, and he told his mom, he said, "Tell my grandfather to look after my children and my wife," and the mom goes, "What?" I mean, this is a 1.5-year-old saying this. And then she asks him, "Well, who are you?" And he says, "I'm from Agra, and I don't know how I came here." And he then, as she explores this further with him, he mentions that he lived in a very big house, and his sisters were educated, and they wore beautiful saris, and his mother's house was dirty, and she didn't wear the right saris, and she didn't use a car. She typically used the bus, and he wanted to go home. And he would cry every day asking to be taken to Agra. And what was interesting is he then began to share his memories of what, eventually is decided is probably a previous life, and that is that he owned something called Suresh's Radio Shop in Agra, and he had been actually on the black market, and he had been a smuggler. And what had happened is that he had been shot dead by an opposing gang who was also doing black market smuggling. And he then told his brother where Suresh's radio shop was in Agra. The brother went there, found the widow, found the family of the previous Suresh, and they met his family, and they basically validated, when the researcher, this is Antonio Mills, was doing this, they validated 15 statements he had made before they met the second family, and another 31 statements afterwards, and they were like amazingly detailed statements that in this case, he was now 4 years old by this time, no four-year-old would be able to know. I mean, for example, where in the previous radio shop the cash drawer was. When he was taken to that radio shop, he went right to the cash drawer and opened it up, and he identified the manager by name.
It defies logic, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. It's like, how could this possibly be? And I keep thinking, well, could it be chance? How could you have chance that was so detailed and so explicit?
Did you conclude with your research on these near-death experiences that, regardless of your belief system now, that it was indeed happening?
Absolutely. There is no question. I mean, when again, people can give information in the near-death experiences of things that are happening in the operating room. And again, going back to the Bettina Payton story, she went funneled down her awareness back into that operating room after her near-death experience, and she saw her lifeless body, and then she watched the senior surgeon who entered the room, wove his way through all the people that were around her body, and he reached his hand into her blood-filled abdomen at this point, and he finds her aorta and reaches around with his fingers and stops the blood from going out of it so that her heart can start pumping again. She sees all that happening, and she recognizes him later on. She'd never seen him before. And after the operation is over, she actually talks to him because she was so amazed at what he had done. So it's like, what can we say about that? It's like everything she saw in the operating room actually was verified. And she, in fact, when she actually opened her eyes in the recovery room, people are standing around her, including her MD husband, who's an atheist. And she still has a trachea tube in her throat, so she can't speak, but she asks for a piece of paper, and they give her a napkin. And she writes, "I know I had a baby girl. I know that I had a hysterectomy, and I know that my heart stopped." So they would know, before they could say anything, that she knew everything from the operation. I mean, I can't deny that that's real when I hear those stories.
And energy healing is somewhat related to that, in that it's tapping into the same kind of force, isn't it?
Exactly. And again, I was always skeptical. My husband loved things like Reiki and energy healing, and he would go to take Reiki workshops, and I would be skeptical and raise my eyebrows. And then at one point, as I began to teach alternative medicine at the university, I decided to teach an alternative medicine class. All of these modalities were covered in the textbook, and I thought, well, as a professor, I need to actually try out these modalities so that I can talk to my students about them both from the research perspective but firsthand. And I went to a Reiki practitioner just to see what it was like. And I was, first of all, amazed at the experience that I had when she was basically doing this energy healing over all the various parts of my body. But even more than that, she knew things about me that I was amazed about, in terms of things about my mother, my father, in fact, my meditation teacher that she told me about during this session. I'm thinking, this is phenomenal. She really does have sort of an access to some sort of non-local consciousness that I was very surprised about. And I could also feel it in the way the energy felt as she was moving her hands over my body. It was very powerful.
Marjorie, why don't they teach any of this energy healing to medical practitioners, students who want to become doctors?
Well, so this is an interesting point. I actually didn't think they did at all until I started teaching this class. And my students were very skeptical of things like Reiki. And then I went actually online to various university medical schools, like, mm-hmm. for example, Yale University, Harvard University, Stanford University.
The big ones.
The big ones. And each one of those has acupuncture classes for MDs that want to be trained in acupuncture. And Yale has a Reiki clinic for people that want Reiki in the hospital, and they do research on Reiki, and they've actually shown positively that Reiki can improve cardiac variability, in this case, in people that have had cardiac arrest, and compared to controls. They do very careful studies. And so, literally, it's out there now, and these major medical schools are actually giving people training in these areas. I was amazed.
That is exciting work too, isn't it? Of everything you wrote about in Infinite Awareness, what was your favorite topic?
Wow, I think one of my favorite topics was the reincarnation story of a boy named James Leininger.
And I know that. That's right. That's a great story. The little pilot boy, right?
The little pilot boy, exactly. And reading his story again, because he was the son of Christian parents who didn't believe in reincarnation, and therefore they had a lot of their own concepts to get over to be willing to accept what he was saying, was one of the powerful parts of that experience. Because so often people say, oh, it's just because this story happened in India. Well, those people believe in reincarnation. We can't really trust them. But when you have a family that doesn't, and the child, as you say, says, you know, I was a pilot, my airplane crashed and it was on fire and I couldn't get out. And then he tells his dad what type of plane he flew and the fact that he was on this USS Natoma Bay escort during World War II.
Concords, and the tires would blow out when they landed sometimes. And he was one of the few to know. Even some of the pilots said that was a secret. They didn't want it to get out. Marjorie, stay with us. We're coming back. We're going to take phone calls, and we'll continue talking about your work, Infinite Awareness.